The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page with the cover story headline, The Outsiders. With backing from national and international financiers, online home buying companies embark on the Triangle to disrupt a hyperactive housing market. And the story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline, New Approach Knocking in Real Estate Game. Open Door began a transformation of the industry, but where is this disruption headed? And this article is written by Ben Graham. A billboard that hovered above the Durham Freeway south of town summed up the appeal of Open Door, a fast-growing real estate startup that planted its flag in the Triangle less than a year ago and is buying up homes from Clayton to Chapel Hill. Clickety-click-click, house sold, the sign read, luring passers-by with a simple promise, forget the hassle of finding a real estate agent, listing your house, and waiting for a buyer. Open Door has carpeted the Triangle with similar radio and television advertisements, touting a business model designed to appeal to internet-savvy homeowners. With just a few clicks of your mouse, you can sell your home to Open Door as if it were a t-shirt on Amazon.com. The company already has more than 700 employees and a valuation of more than $2 billion, according to some estimates. It also has spawned an army of imitators, including OfferPad and Knock, which opened in the Triangle in June. Even Zillow has jumped in the game, launching its Zillow Offers service in the Raleigh area earlier this month. The business models differ, but their underlying goals are similar, to shake up an industry that has been resistant to technological upheaval by making it easier for consumers to buy and sell homes. Despite the novelty of the service, homeowners are taking note. From January through September, Open Door bought more than 500 homes in Wake, Durham, Orange, and Johnston counties and sold nearly 200, according to county property records. Those numbers appear to be growing. In Wake County alone, Open Door bought nearly 60 homes in September, almost 4% of all homes that closed that month. Across the country, Open Door is growing at a fast clip, and other companies are ramping up as well. In the Triangle, rival service Knock says it is currently working with 100 customers. The rise of iBuyers, as some analysts call them, is raising concerns among real estate agents, similar in some ways to how cab drivers first viewed Uber or how hotel owners have eyed Airbnb. While companies like Open Door say they can work with agents, some view these new firms as direct competitors seeking to cut into their annual sales numbers, potentially hurting mom-and-pop real estate outfits that have been helping locals buy and sell homes for generations. Others have a dim view of these upstarts and what it could mean for their business and consumers. Linda Kraft, a longtime Triangle real estate agent, equates Open Door to the developers who post signs in gentrifying neighborhoods offering to buy homes for cash, often for much less than what a home might be worth. This is the exact same thing, except it's dressed up a lot better because there's so much money behind it and they're using technology and mass media to reach their audience, she says. Real estate disruption. Open Door, founded in San Francisco in 2014 by tech veterans from companies such as Trulia and Uber, is attempting to change the way Americans buy and sell homes. Open Door's business model is straightforward. The company buys homes, funds any required repairs, and then sells them on the open market, charging a healthy fee to the initial seller. But the process isn't quite as simple as the advertising makes it out to be. Homeowners can log on to the company's website, fill out a form, and get an offer on their home from the company with just a few clicks of the mouse. But before Open Door actually buys a home, they inspect it in person. This requires sending a team of professionals to the house for a tour, but the company has streamlined this process, which officials say is part of the benefit to consumers. With iPad in hand, a team of estimators descends on the home at a prearranged time, checking for damage that might require repairs or upgrades, stained carpet, ding doors, old wallpaper, snapping photos along the way, and sending the data to analysts back at the main office. Inspections don't take much longer than an hour. If everything checks out, Open Door will make a final offer on the home. With the bid in hand, the home seller can then decide exactly when to move out, potentially coordinating the date with a move elsewhere. All of that happens without the seller having to schedule showings or repairs. On the buying side, Open Door installs smart locks on homes it owns, allowing potential buyers to download an app and, after a short background check, access a house solo without having to schedule the time with an agent. The real value is the certainty and control and convenience, says John Enberg, Open Door General Manager for the Raleigh-Durham market. What consumers are sacrificing for that convenience is less clear. When a homeowner agrees to sell to the company, he or she might be passing up on a better deal they could be getting on the open market. And the current temperature of housing in the Triangle is such that it's not so difficult to sell one's home. Many houses are getting multiple offers from buyers, and prices continue to trend up. If you go on their website or listen to their sales pitch, they're offering this simple, stress-free, no-hassle, easy button for real estate, says Johnny Chappell, a real estate agent with Chappell Residential. But the counter-argument to that is, why would you sell yourself short in what is a very strong market? Convenience for a price. In September, 10% of home sales across the Triangle had competing offers excluding new home construction, representing a steady increase over recent years. Meanwhile, median home sales prices have risen almost 7% year over year, continuing a years-long trend of home value appreciation. But for buyers who forego the open market by selling to Open Door, the appeal is, as the company says, it's easier and quicker. In these cases, some sellers say the potential losses are worth the trade-off. That might be because homeowners are looking to move quickly or are having trouble selling their home. Diener Joseph, a pastor at Pleasant Grove Church in Apex, found this to be true with his home in Cary, which sat on the market for 6 months before he decided to sell to Open Door. He and his family had received several offers, but potential buyers wanted additional work done to the house. That was not the case with Open Door. They're not asking us to do all this foolishness, Joseph says. He eventually sold the house to Open Door for $316,000 in February. In July, Open Door sold the home for $325,000. Open Door says its average service charge in the Triangle is 5.5%, but has also said the fee can range as high as 12%. Real estate agent fees are often at the lower end of that range, according to some agents. Joseph acknowledges he likely could have gotten a better price had he kept the home on the market, but he and his family had already built a new home and were looking to move. Everything considered, from what I know, the experience wasn't unpleasant, he says. It was just one of those things. The timing was perfect. Exactly how much Open Door is making on home appreciation rather than fees is difficult to calculate. The deed records don't reveal how much it spends on such things as repairs. But that is the suspicion that skeptics have, that Open Door's business is a price appreciation harvesting model, says Stephen Kim, an analyst at Evercore ISI. That's another term for being a home flipper, he says. But Kim, who studies the housing market and has met with Open Door's owners, believes the business is based more on the fees charged. Their business model is a service model, he says. They are providing a service, a convenience for customers. What they are primarily trying to do is give you an accurate bid, not a low bid. Keeping the fee low is also key if Open Door is going to compete with real estate agents. If the company can scale, Open Door can leverage overhead to keep fees down, Kim says. Location, location, location. Open Door doesn't buy or sell real estate in San Francisco, where its headquarters is located. Instead, the company has sought out fast-growing markets, places where housing might be undervalued and sales volumes are strong. And the growth is coming fast. Open Door is now in 14 markets and counting and continues to pile up home acquisitions in the Triangle. Because of the Triangle's growing housing market, the region has topped the list for many of the iBuyers now flooding the market. Knock followed on the heels of Open Door, launching a Triangle office this summer. The company, started by a founder of Trulia, Sean Black, is still operating with a small team out of rented office space at Industrious in downtown Raleigh's Charter Square office building, but is already seeing demand for its business model, which is in some ways the opposite of Open Door. Instead of buying homes from its customers, Knock buys the next home for its customers. Like other iBuyers, Knock uses algorithms and data science to estimate the price of your home, but then Knock puts a twist on the iBuyer model, offering to buy the next house that the homeowner wants to move into. The customer can then move into that home while Knock lists the old home on the market and helps the customer sell it. When that deal closes, Knock then also finalizes the sale of the new house to the owner of the former house. The business model is supposed to help provide potential buyers with the cash they need to buy their next home, which can help people close quickly on a new house in a competitive market. The triangle has a lot of problems we're trying to solve, says Elizabeth Riddick, Knox Director of Sales Development. The added benefit for the consumer is that it is in Knox's benefit to get the homeowner the best price for their home, because Knox makes its money from the fees on the sale. Big money pouring in. Regardless of which business models end up sticking, investors are taking note. In September, Japanese conglomerate SoftBank Group Corporation, the same group that has pumped money into co-working giant WeWork, announced a $400 million investment in Open Door. Home builders have latched onto the burgeoning industry as well. In June, Open Door closed on a $325 million Series E funding round, including investment from home building giant Lennar, and Open Door has raised $645 million overall so far, according to Reuters. At the same time, Lennar has launched a new program with Open Door, in which people looking to trade up into a bigger, more expensive home within a Lennar community can sell their old home to Open Door, a service that Lennar executives have equated to trading in your car. The net result of more iBuyers in the marketplace, making it easier to buy and sell homes, could mean more transactions. It could potentially increase mobility, Kim says. It reduces the friction of buying and selling homes. To keep the transactions flowing, Open Door and Knock are targeting specific price points in the triangle. The average priced home that Knock is buying for customers is just over $300,000, says Riddick, who previously held top sales positions at major home building companies, including Lennar. The homes they are selling, those that previously belonged to their customers, are typically under $270,000. Open Door, meanwhile, is targeting homes under $500,000 with an ideal price tag somewhere much below that. Officials from both Knock and Open Door say they don't mind the competition from fellow iBuyers jockeying for a position in the triangle. If anything, the more real estate tech companies gain market share, the more it helps show homeowners that there are other non-traditional ways to buy and sell homes. The market is so ready for a change, says Knox Riddick. You can just feel it. Now we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook as it relates to the cover story. And the headline is, Are These Online Home Buying Companies Disrupting Anything? And this is written by Sugathar Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. After more than 10 years, my neighbor recently decided to move back to Canada because of a great job opportunity. The fact that his three boys play competitive hockey made the decision even easier. So about 4 months ago, he put his house up for sale through a real estate agent. The house did not sell, despite the fact that at least three other houses in that neighborhood sold within a week, also through a real estate agent. To get his house sold, my neighbor cut a deal with Open Door, the online home buying service. After taking a big cut from his listing price, he packed up and left for good. The house still has an Open Door sign in the yard. In this case, selling the house much below the asking price helped my neighbor, who probably needed to unload the house so he could buy one in Canada. In that instance, an online home buying service worked. As our cover story this week from Ben Graham suggests, online home buying service providers are streaming into the triangle because the market is hot. These companies believe that when people are in a rush, they would like to unload their assets ASAP and move on. With the triangle housing inventory levels at record lows, service providers such as Open Door, Knock, and Zillow Offers are hoping they can flip these houses easily and make a pretty penny. That all sounds great except for one issue. There are more people moving into Wake County than leaving. Wake County gains an average of 63 new residents each day, with 42 from domestic and international migration. In 2017, migration accounted for 68% of population growth in Wake County. Sure, there are people leaving and the online model may suit them, but the market is not big enough for online companies with backing from big international banks and private equity firms who like big returns within 7 years. Open Door has bought 500 homes in the Triangle and sold about 200 of them this year. That's a sale of about 20 homes per month, simply not enough for a corporation. Coldwell Banker and Fonville Morrissey collectively sell more than 15,000 homes every year, more than 1,250 per month. That may be a totally different model, but it allows us a comparative look. It is very doubtful, at least for now, that people moving into the area for the first time would rely on an online service to make what many consider their biggest purchase in life. They most likely would rely on realtors who can show them around neighborhoods close to businesses, schools, and playgrounds. To me, these online home buying services are not disruptors at all. Uber and Airbnb have disrupted the transportation and lodging model. These home buying services are simply opportunists. Nothing wrong with that, but let's not compare them to the real disruptors. When the housing market gets weak, what are the chances these business models would work? For this model to be effective, these companies have to make money from buying and selling homes. When both go down during an economic downturn and homes remain on the market for months, flipping homes gets tough, unless you have a fire sale. That, in turn, lowers returns. To all the real estate agents in town, I say this. Discover a hybrid model where you can offer online and personal service that may allow for a limited ability to buy a house without finding a buyer for the client. There are financial institutions that could come in as a partner. For now, however, I am still looking for that disruption. Also on the Viewpoint page, we'll read the column of Andrew Broad, who is a senior research fellow at UNC Greensboro Center for Business and Economic Research. The headline of his column, Trump Media Confused Principle of Time Value of Money. Earlier this month, the New York Times published an investigative report about the origins of President Donald Trump's wealth. It focused on the potentially fraudulent means his father used to transfer funds to him and his siblings without incurring estate and gift taxes. In many places, the lengthy article expressed the dollar amounts from decades ago in today's dollars to provide the reader with some monetary context. The president took note of this context, but in doing so, he got a basic business principle wrong. In essence, he confused interest with inflation. At least one major business news site repeated this error. I'll correct that error here. In a tweet, the president said the Times article had used the concept of time value of money in doing a hit piece on me. That was wrong. The concept used by the Times was inflation. An explainer by CNBC said the president went back to Economics 101. But its explanation of time value of money was wrong because it, too, confused interest with inflation. The CNBC article started off in the right direction, noting that the value of money today will not be equal to the value to the same amount of money in the future. But the example CNBC used to illustrate this was way off. A Hershey bar cost about 2 cents when it was first introduced more than 100 years ago. That same chocolate bar costs close to $2 today. Sorry, but that Hershey bar's price increased from 2 cents to $2 because of inflation, not interest. Inflation is also why the funds the young Donald Trump received from his father are larger when expressed in today's dollars. A writer for New York Magazine continued the parade of wrongness, saying that because of the time value of money, a person would rather be given $1,000 today than be guaranteed a payment of $1,000 10 years from now, because inflation erodes its values. Its value. Sigh. So let's get back to Economics 101 and get it right. The time value of money is a function of interest, not inflation. Interest and inflation play completely different roles in determining monetary values. Even if there is no inflation, money has a time value that derives from the holder's ability to invest it and earn a rate of return. Suppose the interest rate is 5%, and suppose it's a real rather than a nominal rate, meaning that inflation is out of the picture. It's better to receive $100 now instead of $100 next year, because if it's received now, it can be invested to yield $105 next year. Obviously, $105 next year is better than $100 next year, and it has nothing to do with inflation. The time value of money is behind nearly everything in finance. It's the basis of discounted present value of interest and returns to equity, of structured settlements and annuities. Sure, the most important thing about the Times article was its finding that President Trump's wealth is due largely to the generosity of his father. But the confusion between interest and inflation was interesting, too. The New York Magazine writer said that the time value of money is a very basic principle and anybody in business should know. I agree, and I've done my job with this column. You know something about business. Now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Franklin Street, not always a sweet deal for merchants. It's another casualty along Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. Cupcake shop Sugarland has filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy, listing assets of less than $50,000 and debts of between $50,000 and $100,000, according to the filing. In August, a Triangle Business Journal cover story profiled how small businesses can face tough times along the iconic street. That story included the UNC Chapel Hill. Which was Sugarland's landlord, had raised the rent by 2% to $3,052 in August for the 1,420-square-foot space occupied by Sugarland. Sugarland had previously closed a shop in Cameron Village in Raleigh. The bakery owners, Randolph and Katrina Ryan, filed for individual Chapter 7 bankruptcy October 23. According to court documents, no property appears to be available to pay creditors. Guess those creditors weren't willing to barter for Almond Bliss cupcakes. Johnston County leader reaches out over bond issue. If you're driving east on I-40, even at 6:30 a.m., you'll see a stream of cars on the highway from Johnston County into Wake County. That's an issue for Johnston County leaders who want to see more of their workforce staying in the county. Lower land prices in Johnston County have made the market a prime target for Triangle workers, but, says Harold Keene, president and CEO of KS Bancorp, the way to turn this around is to provide a quality workforce so that people will want to locate here. That's why Keene is picking up the phone and pushing a $76 million school bond referendum on the November ballot. Of that, $61 million would go to the public schools and $15 million to Johnston County Community College. The issue hasn't received as much attention as the Wake County bonds, including one for $548 million to build schools. No one knows it's there, says Keene, who believes jobs are at stake. He says the county is focused on teaching science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. We need to provide quality schools and quality workers so businesses will want to locate in Johnston County and cut down on all that commuting, Keene says. New hotel makes its mark in downtown Raleigh. When the 10-story Residence Inn Raleigh Downtown Hotel opened on Salisbury Street in the summer of 2017, the Marriott-branded hotel was the first new lodging establishment to open in the city's core since 2012. While new hotel proposals have cropped up since then, the Residence Inn continues to lead the new wave of hotel development downtown in a new category. The 175-room building has received LEED Silver status from the U.S. Green Building Council, a first for a downtown Raleigh hotel. The Green Building Certification Program recognizes buildings that meet a variety of standards in their design, construction, and operation. For the Residence Inn, those qualifications were met in everything from the local eggs and vegetables served in the hotel to the recycled material used in staff uniforms, according to a statement from developer Summit Hospitality Group. So when exactly is Amazon going to deliver HQ2? Amazon has a reputation for quick deliveries, but here at Biz, we're still wondering when the final word on HQ2 will arrive. The company dropped a bombshell last year when it announced the race for its second headquarters. The deadline for the initial request for proposal was October 19, 2017, and the only date given for the final selection and announcement was 2018. In a recent interview in Washington, D.C., CEO Jeff Bezos said the company would make the decision before the end of the year, but offered no details on potential finalists or timelines. You can bet that the company won't be making any announcements until after the midterm elections. For tech, study shows the Triangle is the place to be. Working in tech in the Triangle, you're in the right place, or at least the second best place in the best state. A recent study by CompTIA ranked Raleigh as the second best tech town in the nation based on an analysis of open technology jobs, projected job growth, and cost of living. The study ranks Charlotte the number one city, not too far away if you're having doubts about being the second best. The list, which only ranked the top 20 cities, also placed Durham, Chapel Hill in the number 15 slot. The study judged harshly on cities with inflating cost of living prices, but said some areas are still attractive to tech talent because of the abundance of job openings. Cities trailing behind Raleigh include Austin, Texas, San Jose, California, San Francisco, Dallas, and Seattle. And finally, Voice of RDU leaves for new position in Triangle. Kristen Van Auken has left her role as Vice President of Communications and Community Affairs at Raleigh-Durham International Airport, taking on a new challenge at the Research Triangle Foundation. At RTF, the managing entity over Research Triangle Park, she'll serve as Vice President of Stakeholder Engagement, where she will look to strengthen the relationships with tenants, universities, and regional partners. We wish her the best in her endeavors and look forward to working with all of our partners in the Triangle to support the growth of our region, said RDU Airport Authority CEO Michael Landguth. Now we turn to the On Technology and Finance page written by Lauren Onasorge. Federal judge dismisses suit by Raleigh diplomat's daughter. Nearly 2 years after the daughter of Raleigh diplomat Jim Kane sued Twitter, accusing the company of knowingly providing material support and resources to the Islamic State group, the lawsuit has been dismissed in federal court. U.S. District Judge James Donato of the Northern District of California dismissed the case with prejudice October 22, meaning the plaintiffs, including Ann Cameron Kane, are barred from bringing forward another lawsuit on the same claim. Kane, whose husband, Alexander Pinkowski, died in a 2016 terrorist attack in Brussels, had filed suit in January 2017. Kane, along with Beatriz Gonzalez, whose daughter died in the 2015 Paris attacks, had initially filed the lawsuit in the Southern District of New York, asking for compensatory damages against Twitter, as well as an order declaring that Twitter has violated and continues to violate the Anti-Terrorism Act. Kane's father served as U.S. ambassador to Denmark from July 2005 to January 2009. Prior to that post, he was the president of the Carolina Hurricanes. Twitter, social media platform, and services provide tremendous utility and value to ISIS as a tool to connect its members and to facilitate the terrorist group's ability to communicate, recruit members, plan and carry out attacks, and strike fear in its enemies, the suit, which was later transferred to a federal court in Northern California, reads. The court had dismissed the case without prejudice on September 24 for failure to state a claim. That order had given plaintiffs until October 15 to file an amended complaint. In his recent order, Donato notes that the court hadn't received an amended complaint, hence the final ruling. In the September 24 order, Donato writes that the court fully appreciates their desire to bring the responsible parties to justice, but adds, social media platforms like Twitter are not liable under the Anti-Terrorism Act on the facts alleged. It continues, Kane plans to appeal. Verizon retailer behind 250 jobs pledge pulls out of $3.3 million incentives deal with North Carolina. More than a year after announcing plans to create 250 jobs at a new Raleigh headquarters in exchange for up to $3.3 million in state incentives, a wireless, now known as Victra, is pulling out of the deal. At the October 23 Economic Investments Committee meeting, state officials approved the termination of the Verizon retailer's jobs development investment grant at the company's request, but Victra CEO George Sherman says the firm is still on track to create the jobs. We're going to consolidate virtually everything into Raleigh, he says. With respect to the JDIG grant, the fundamental change is our desire to move the overwhelming majority of our team to Raleigh. We found the synergy, collaboration, and culture to be an advantage we can't pass up. As a result, we'll be unable to meet the provisions relating to jobs remaining in Greenville. The JDIG terms had required that Victra add jobs to Greenville, too, but the plan has changed, Sherman says. In 2017, the company had 88 positions at what it was then calling its dual headquarters in Greenville. JDIG terms called for transferring 60 of those to Wake County, but they also required Victra's pledge to move 40 positions from an out-of-state location to Greenville. While the company's notice to the state, dated October 10, outlines plans to consolidate all retained positions from Pitt County into its Raleigh headquarters, Sherman says a small number of employees at a legacy reverse logistics operation in Greenville will remain. Diaper entrepreneur tackles new challenge, liquor. Scott Bolin, the serial entrepreneur behind diaper technology startup Tethys, is tackling a new challenge, liquor, and investors are betting $3.6 million that he can disrupt that industry too. Bolin, CEO of intellectual property holding firm Anavo Technologies, announced October 18 that the new company had spun out its first startup, Raleigh-based Next Century Spirits, and it's being supported by a $3.6 million investment led by Chapel Hill private equity firm Blue Hill Group. Years ago, a researcher at Tethys got obsessed with liquor, he says, and how it has to age in a barrel for years. He created an invention that allows us to get those same flavors much more quickly and at a very large scale, he says. The team prototyped the technology for a year, working out of a Durham distillery with a 300,000-liter annual capacity. Then the company split in two. Tethys would push forward in diapers, and Anabo, the second entity, would explore other applications. Bolin went with Anabo, as did the liquor idea. Bolin says signs point to an early success. Think raises $24 million, plots even more growth, and that's Think spelled T-H-I-N-Q. Think, a Raleigh-based telecom technology firm, just raised its first major round of funding, a whopping $24 million. CEO Aaron Leon says that until recently he never would have considered an A round at all and was perfectly content with pushing out communications as a service offerings for major enterprises. From bootstrap to cash flow positive, Think, or it's also pronounced Think You, was chugging along, but the constant grind was taxing, he admits. 2 years ago, he realized it just made more sense to finally raise money. I would say we spoke with 50 or 60 private equity firms, Leon says. Turn River Capital, a California technology growth equity and buyout firm, emerged as the best fit. They're perfect for that young, energetic, almost millennial-type entrepreneurial company. They think like us. They talk like us. They're motivated like us, he adds. Think currently employs about 40 and will soon start expanding, Leon says. This really puts fuel into the tank for us to grow faster than we were able to do before, he explains, noting that for the first time, Think has a marketing budget, which will translate into sales hires. We do really well in North Carolina. We do really well with word of mouth. We do really well with referrals, but we weren't able to get nationally recognized because we didn't have a marketing budget. Leon won't say how many jobs could be created with the financing round, though he does acknowledge that he expects significant growth. And finally, in the On the Record section, we have a quote. Raleigh is a key market, so having signage visibility in a thriving part of the business community is a great thing for the bank and demonstrates our long-term commitment to the market. That's from Laura Bunn, Triangle Market President for the First Horizon National-owned Bank Capital Bank. Shortly after the bank announced its moving to its Raleigh headquarters to the One Glenwood building in downtown Raleigh. Now we turn to the On Real Estate pages written by Ben Graham. Inside the plans to jumpstart RTP's Park Center. The future Park Center site in Research Triangle Park is crisscrossed with crumbling roads and empty parking lots. The 43-acre property has just two tenants at the moment, small branches of Wells Fargo and Bank of America. Bushes grow tall around several abandoned buildings, while more than 200,000 vehicles zoom by daily on Interstate 40 just to the north. To Tom Sebastian, a senior vice president at Willard Retail, the property could be a new urban destination. More than 50,000 high-tech employees work in the park, while 155,000 workers sit at cubicles within a 10-minute drive. And where do all these people eat lunch and dinner? That's an opportunity, Sebastian says. Willard Retail has a deal to buy 12 acres and build a 150,000-square-foot complex intended to jumpstart hotel, office, and residential developments. Willard completed the King of Prussia Town Center shopping complex in an affluent suburb of Philadelphia. That area had a plethora of residents and high-paying jobs, but little retail. The new shopping complex changed that, building a number of retail spaces, breweries, and a Wegmans grocery store. Soon, more than 2,000 apartments were under construction, Sebastian says. Board members from the Research Triangle Foundation, the organization that oversees development at RTP, were sold on Willard Retail's success. They have transformed perceptions of markets where they've done retail development, says RTF CEO Scott Levitan. And that is exactly what Willard Retail is hoping to do with the first phase of Park Center. Aging Durham Center sold to Greenville's Brody Co. A Greenville developer has bought the 1960s era Lakewood Shopping Center south of downtown Durham in a foreclosure sale and is planning to revitalize the property. Brody Co. won the rights to acquire the 82,000-square-foot complex, anchored by a Food Lion and Dollar General, by submitting a bid of $5.25 million in a public sale, according to documents filed this month in Durham County Superior Court. Brody Co. CEO Hyman Brody said the firm is analyzing the property to see what additions are a good fit. The shopping center was built in the 1960s and once served as a retail and entertainment destination, including an amusement park with a roller coaster. Durham's Northgate Mall owners look to avoid foreclosure. The owners of Northgate Mall say they are attempting to stave off foreclosure proceedings initiated by the private equity firm that bought the debt secured by the mall earlier this year. That company, Northwood Investors, acquired promissory notes tied to the property in June when it bought the Sears building attached to the mall. Now the Denver firm is calling in the debt. According to documents filed in Durham County Superior Court, the mall ownership group is now in default on the loans valued at nearly $62 million. A foreclosure sale could take place as soon as December 14, according to an order from the court clerk. This week, Northgate received confirmation that the foreclosure action is proceeding, but the court is allowing us more time to come up with a strategy to move forward, according to a statement from Northgate Associates, the mall owners. The group says there will be no immediate changes for tenants or in the mall's daily operations, at least through the end of the year. Virginia Ginny Rand Bowman is the managing general partner of the ownership entity. Bowman's father, Keenan Rand, built the mall on a 50-acre tobacco farm he bought on the northern edge of Durham in the late 1950s. Trampoline Park takes former H.H. Gregg space in Apex. It's been more than a year since H.H. Gregg announced it was closing all 220 stores across the country, including five in the Triangle, but the former Shells that house the electronics chain are leasing up. The latest deal is for a trampoline park company, which will open a new location at Apex Beaver Creek Commons soon. Defy Apex has signed a lease to occupy the 34,000-square-foot space, according to real estate agents who worked on the deal. With the lease now signed, three of the five former H.H. Gregg spaces have been taken. O2 Fitness is moving into 30,000 square feet at Raleigh's Briar Creek later this year. That was previously an H.H. Gregg. Ashley's Furniture Home Store has also taken over the H.H. Gregg building on Piney Plains Road in Cary. The two remaining vacant H.H. Gregg boxes are at 8160 Renaissance Parkway in Durham and 6180 Capitol Boulevard in Raleigh. Defy is part of a fast-growing network of indoor trampoline parks fanning out across the country and globe, started by an entrepreneur who lives in Raleigh. Mike Carpenter co-founded Defy, now under the parent company Circus Tricks, 7 years ago in California. What started out as two locations has quickly grown into 300 parks in the U.S. and Europe, funded in part by New York private equity firm Palladium, which bought a 60% stake in the company last year. And finally, new steakhouse coming next to Crabtree Valley Mall. Raleigh residents will soon have a new place to order a porterhouse or filet mignon near Crabtree Valley Mall. The developers behind the 145,000-square-foot Crabtree Terrace building, now under construction, have inked a deal to bring Perry's Steakhouse and Grill to the Triangle. The Texas-based restaurant will occupy more than 12,000 square feet, taking up a sizable and prominent corner on the ground floor. The restaurant, designed in partnership with the restaurant architect Aria Group Architects Incorporated, will have space for 350 guests in addition to a towering wine wall, an island bar, and four private dining rooms, according to a news release. The steakhouse serves prime USDA-aged steaks and carves up the meat table side. Among the dishes are the Hanging Symphony Kebab, Southwest Filet, Fried Asparagus with Lump Crab, Signature Steak Additions, and Desserts Flamed Tableside. Perry's will be joining Longleaf Law Partners and co-working company Spaces in the building, being developed by East West Partners. Now we turn to the On Healthcare page, written by Seth Gulledge, comparing ER wait times at Triangle Hospitals. No one likes waiting in line, especially for a doctor. When it comes to emergency departments, people tend to be even more impatient, but Triangle healthcare providers say they have made huge improvements to efficiency over the years. According to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the average emergency department wait time in North Carolina is 26 minutes, 4 minutes higher than the national average. The average reflects the amount of time a patient spent before being seen by a healthcare professional. Of course, the emergency departments operate based on a patient acuity, meaning high-risk patients receive the most timely care, less serious cases are treated after, affecting the averages reflected in the report. In the olden days, you'd be in the waiting room and then you'd get called in order of your acuity. Then you'd go through triage. Then you'd sit there and wait until you could get back to a bed, says Kim Boyer, emergency department director of UNC Rex Hospital. Everything kind of went step by step. What we're trying to do is eliminate some of those in-between steps so we can take care of patients faster. Brittany Komansky, WakeMed Raleigh's emergency department director, says a priority has been getting lower acuity patients to a doctor quickly, but also out of that bed quickly. Both departments say they have worked to keep patients upright by moving them from bed areas to specific sitting areas where they can wait for various follow-ups that they may need after seeing a doctor, whether that be x-rays or lab tests. Researchers hope UNC's new partnership will speed up drug pipeline. UNC Chapel Hill hopes to use a $65 million partnership with a New York investment company to untap the university's drug pipeline. UNC recently announced a deal with Deerfield Management LLC and creation of a new company, Pinnacle Hill LLC. Jim Flynn, managing partner of Deerfield, says the firm wants to provide a platform for ideas to advance. We're making the bet, and it is a bet, that we can do that with an efficiency that was not available in the past that creates a positive economic return for this kind of investment, he says. Kay Wagner, the university's associate director for the Eshelman Institute for Innovation, hopes that the partnership can bring advantageous results for people with real needs. UNC's Rex Health Ventures invests in technology app. Rex Health Ventures, the investing arm of UNC Rex, is investing in a California medical technology company that produces an iPad app that tracks blood loss for mothers during childbirth. Rex Health Ventures recently announced its participation in a recent $20 million fundraising round by Gauze Surgical. Based in Silicon Valley, Gauze's flagship technology, Triton, monitors surgical blood loss using a digital imaging and machine learning on an iPad through methods such as analyzing sponges and rags to estimate blood loss. Since March, the Rex's Women's Center in Raleigh has used the technology in about 2,400 deliveries. April LaLumiere, director of the Rex Women's Center, says that has improved its ability to recognize bleeding issues early. Aerie completes Durham headquarters expansion. Aerie Pharmaceuticals is bolstering its Triangle area infrastructure in a move to prepare for more clinical testing and on-site production. The Durham company recently announced the completion of its headquarters expansion, bringing the total square footage to more than 61,000. The company now occupies an entire building on an Emperor Boulevard with about 70 employees. What we look for in all areas we operate in is, can we draw the talent we're looking for that is specific to a skill set in that area, says Vincent Anito Jr., chairman and CEO. Clearly, we have no interest in building lab space or doing research outside of RTP. He says the company plans to use the upgraded facility to produce all the clinical product supply necessary for Aerie's two lead development programs, which focus on retinal diseases. And finally, here's what Duke seeks in applicants. Last year, Duke University received 37,300 applications, and only 1,746 of those walked onto the campus in August. Want to be a Blue Devil? Christoph Gutentag, Duke's Dean of Undergraduate Admissions, has some advice. Be personal. Aside from having good grades, the application essay is critical. Demonstrate more than just talent. He says admission experts are clearly looking for students to demonstrate their strengths and showcase their talent, but what makes a candidate stand out is the application of those strengths. Demonstrate intellectual curiosity. Admission experts want to see that a student is actively pursuing learning, not just checking boxes to get into college. And we'll stop there as we summarized some of the details of that article. Now we'll turn to the small business section. We'll read the executive voice that focuses on Jenny Bonchak. Name, Jenny Bonchak. Title, founder and CEO, company, Slingshot Coffee Company. Education, BA, University of Pittsburgh. Family, husband Jonathan. Hometown, Jamestown, Pennsylvania. First ever job, harvesting vegetables and fruit on our family's 300-acre farm. And this Q&A is written by Lauren Onisorch. The headline, Taking Coffee in Fresh New Directions. Armed with a new headquarters and, as of August, a new product line in sodas, Raleigh entrepreneur Jenny Bonchak is gearing up to be the next beverage mogul. Her company, Slingshot Coffee, is known for its cold brew coffees and specialty teas, but is now branching out. In addition to reaching new retailers, it has entered the soda space with a coffee soda combo inspired by flavors from her childhood. And the company, which now has 10 employees, is pumping out cans from a new Raleigh manufacturing facility. It just feels so good to be in a home that we know we'll be able to grow in for the next several years, she says. When you were 8 years old, what did you want to be when you grew up? I wanted to work in the music industry as far back as I can remember, and I did that after I graduated from college. Why did you start Slingshot? At the time of founding Slingshot, I'd been working in some capacity in the specialty coffee industry for several years. I'm an iced coffee drinker year-round, and even in college when I went to a coffee shop, the iced coffee was always an afterthought and never brewed with much care and thoughtfulness. I had been making cold brew at home for a very long time to get my iced coffee fix, and I continued to see and taste no great iced coffee out there that was crafted through quality sourcing, quality roasting, and skilled brewing. I'm a 3-time National Award-winning barista, so I decided it was time to bottle the magic I was making for so long. Did you have any mentors? I've been fortunate to count John Replogle among one of my longest business mentors, and it just so happens he is a fantastic human as well, and I cannot speak highly enough of the love, wisdom, encouragement, support, and energy I am so lucky to receive from Angela Salamanca, who owns Centro and Gallo Pelone. They make me want to be a better person and a better business owner. I only hope I can one day pay it forward like they do. What's your go-to drink? Ready-to-drink Slingshot is always the first thing I drink in the morning. Midday, I grab one of our Cascara teas, either unsweetened, classic, blueberry jasmine, or Cascarnold, a blend of classic Cascara and fresh lemonade. That gives me a super dose of antioxidants, vitamins, minerals, and a bit of natural caffeine. Mid-afternoon, I reach for a new Slingshot coffee soda, either black cherry cola or citrus vanilla cream soda, a lively, bubbly, reed carbonated take on two classic soda flavors, brewed using our cold brew coffee, fresh juices, and just a hint of natural cane sugar. What are some new flavors we might see in the future? The Cascara teas and coffee sodas are our newest innovations and can be found in several retailers, including Whole Foods. If you could go back and give yourself advice when you started Slingshot, what would you say? Don't be afraid to do this your own way. What's been the biggest challenge so far with Slingshot? Owning a business means you are challenged every single day. Sometimes it's something small, such as picking the perfect playlist to power your team through a big production batch of coffee sodas. Other times it's bigger struggles, such as figuring out the details of bringing on a new retailer. But the biggest hurdle continues to be growing and scaling Slingshot with our single most important goal, quality in every aspect. When did you realize the business model was working? Every time I step into a Whole Foods, a Publix, a Target, a Harris Teeter, an independent retail partner, or even encounter someone new discovering Slingshot, it gives me chills, a huge smile, and a little bit more of a boost to keep going. What's your personal motto? Rise up and greet the day with enthusiasm. How many concoctions did you create before settling on the original Slingshot brew? We were the first cold brew company to highlight the beauty of a single origin coffee and not a secret proprietary blend. We always tell you exactly where that coffee is from on every bottle. To find the right coffee, I experimented with recipes for years. I wanted a coffee that was going to be different, light, bright, juicy, and fruity. So I reached for Ethiopian coffees, as well as a few other single origins, and really spent time brewing. For several reasons, I ultimately chose a lively Ethiopian that Hoda Kotb from the Today Show once said on air. It tastes like fruit juice. How many store locations is Slingshot in now? 1,500 nationwide. Do you have any projections on how that might grow in 2019? We're thrilled to have recently added a new sales director to Team Slingshot, which will continue to grow in 2019. And next year, we also see us continue to expand with new retail partners and new innovations while staying true to our thoughtful approach to growth. What advice do you have for an entrepreneur considering raising equity for the first time? Choose equity partners who believe in you and believe in what you're doing and vice versa. How do you de-stress? Together, Jonathan and I love to walk our dog, Frank. My best, most clear thinking happens on those walks, and I love seeing how happy Frank is when he's out in the fresh air with us. What's something that might surprise Slingshot employees about you? I am dying to learn how to play tennis. Serena, are you reading this? Ever seen a stranger drinking Slingshot in public? And if so, what was your reaction? Yes, and it makes my heart jump. I also love when people who I don't know will stop me just to say how much they love Slingshot. I mean, is this real life? And now the Family Business Column, written by James Lee, who is a family business speaker, advisor, and author. The headline, Be Careful How Non-Family Employees Are Treated. One of the challenges in a family-owned business is maintaining good relationships between family members working in the business and the non-family employees. Both groups are vital. The business wouldn't be a family business without the family members working there, and chances are good that it wouldn't be a business at all without the non-family employees. In the best of all worlds, everyone in the company would work smoothly together toward common goals without undue friction and dispute. But it's hard to get membership in the best of all worlds, so the successful family business heads off trouble before it arises by taking steps to promote compatibility between family and non-family employees. Here are some steps you can take. Require equal qualifications and commitment of family and non-family employees. If family members join the company with no credentials except their last names, the non-family employees will have good reason to resent it. As you bring the younger generation into the business, be sure the other employees recognize they're fully qualified for their jobs and committed to pulling their weight. It's especially important that younger family members on the succession ladder work to really earn the respect of the non-family employees they'll supervise someday. Deliver equal treatment. The other side of that coin is handing out equal treatment to family and non-family alike. You can gift stock and other benefits of ownership to the family members, but distribute performance-linked incentives and rewards without regard to who's related to whom. If going 25% over the sales quota is good for a week in the company beach house, that reward should go to the non-family employee as quickly as it goes to nephew Niles. The same thing applies to discipline. There's nothing that frosts non-family employees faster than seeing the boss's kid breaking the rules and getting away with it. If it becomes a pattern, the employee's morale goes right down the drain. If you allow family membership to non-family employees, be consistent. One of the common characteristics of family-owned companies is a tendency to take a little more interest in employees' welfare than some other companies. In some cases, the family members invite non-family employees to family gatherings, share family confidences with them, and otherwise treat them almost like members of the clan. That can be risky, but if you do it, be consistent. Don't play favorites by allowing some employees that special membership while keeping others out. It'll produce unnecessary jealousy and conflict that's just plain bad for the business. Be honest and upfront about opportunities for advancement. Let's say you've built your business with the loyal help of several key employees, and you decide to start bringing family members in and planning for continued family ownership and management. It's important that you make your intentions clear to your employees as soon as possible. Let them know that yours is a family business and that a non-family member isn't likely to become the CEO or to gain a significant ownership stake. You may lose some people that you'd really like to keep, but you'll prevent their unrealistic expectations from blowing up into conflict with the family members who will always hold the top slots. Remind non-family employees of their value. I hope yours is a company in which the family members running it are a close-knit cooperative team, a successful business with excellent continuity prospects. But don't get so self-congratulatory that you forget to give credit to the non-family employees whose abilities and loyalty have brought the company along and keep it going. In a mix of family and non-family workers, it's especially important to let the non-family employees know how much the family values and appreciates their contributions. Throw picnics, give bonuses, take a personal interest in their families. You'll be giving richly deserved rewards and also keeping family and non-family relationships on an even keel. And now for our remaining minutes, we'll read some news from around the state. Downtown Greensboro Hotel to cost around $8 million. How much will it cost to build the new Hampton Inn and Suites in Greensboro? Perhaps $8 million. That's the amount estimated by Thomas Builders of Tennessee, the general contractor of the downtown project, in a building permit application. In July, Michael Patel of developer CN Hotels of Greensboro said a 120-room hotel was under construction on 1.45 acres. Work began in July on the site, which borders the traffic circle around the statue of General Nathaniel Greene. The Hampton Inn and Suites is one of at least four new hotels. The others are a Hyatt Place, a Westin, and an Aloft under development in a downtown hotel boom in Greensboro. Atrium Novant compete to expand in Mecklenburg. Charlotte's rival healthcare systems are vying for state approval to expand their footprints in Mecklenburg County. Atrium Health of Charlotte filed a certificate of need seeking approval for a $32 million project that would add 50 acute care beds in Pineville. Winston-Salem-based Novant Health filed a competing application to add 12 obstetric acute care beds and one operating room to its Huntersville Medical Center. And our last article that we will not get to just mentions that in Charlotte, land owned by the Freeman family for the last 300 years will be developed primarily into commercial space, retail, and apartments. And that is the land on the east side of Steel Creek Road in Charlotte. And we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138.